This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
5 a.m. I'm up with a crisp Celsius energy drink. Running 12 miles today. Grab a green juice, quick change, and head to work. Meetings, workshops, one more Celsius, no slowing down. Working late, but obviously still meeting the girls for a little dancing. Celsius, live, fit, go. Grab a cold, refreshing Celsius at your local retailer or locate now at Celsius.com.
It's not just something you made. It's the privilege that you get to work with your hands. It's building something that serves a purpose, proof that you have the grit to keep going. At Timberland, we understand you take your craft seriously, and we do too, which is why our products are built to the highest quality. We put in the work so you can perfect yours, with purpose in every detail and crafted with intention. Timberland, built on craft. Visit Timberland.com to shop.
The new Chicken Bacon Ranch Street Chalupa is a Taco Bell. You can't get just one. Okay, so that's not like some marketing hyperbole. You literally can't get just one. They come in twos. So like, if you want just one, you're going to need to find a friend who loves slow-roasted chicken, bacon, and avocado ranch sauce. Or a friend of a friend, or have an awkward conversation with a complete stranger to see if they're obsessed with chicken, bacon, and avocado ranch. Or you could just like eat them both because you're obsessed with slow-roasted chicken, bacon. Okay, you get the idea. The new Chicken Bacon Ranch Street Chalupa is a Taco Bell. At participating Taco Bell U.S. locations for limited time while supplies last.
What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Wing and Tail Boys podcast, your Northeast hunting and fishing destination. I'm Chris.
And I'm Angelo.
And we're your hosts. Join us as we navigate the woods and waters of the Northeast, sharing our passion for the outdoors.
Whether it's land management, outdoor recreation, hunting, or fishing, we're going to cover it all. With 40 plus years of experience in the Northeast, we'll provide insights, tips, and stories to help you make the most of your adventures and help you experience the wild.
So, tune in, grab your gear, and let's hit the woods together. And always remember, success is just a commitment away. How you guys doing today? Thank you again for joining us here for another episode of the Wing and Tail Boys. On today's episode, we're taking a little bit of a different direction here, something never done before. We're being joined by the next up-and-coming country star out of Austin, Texas, if I'm not mistaken, or at least somewhere near down there in Texas. His name is Ben Coleman. He is playing full-time these days. He's got some songs released, and actually tomorrow, the day after the day we are recording this, he has his very first single coming out on the radio. So I'm going to stop talking for a second, and I'm going to let our guests introduce themselves. Ben, if you can, go ahead.
Yeah, Chris, thanks, man. Thanks for having me on the podcast. Excited to be here, talk about hunting, talk about music, two of my favorite things. But yeah, my name is Ben Coleman, lifelong hunter, lifelong musician. Live in Dallas, Fort Worth, play all over Texas, though. And been playing music since I was like seven, and been hunting since I was like seven. So those two things have just been passions of mine. Thankfully, now I get to do it for a living. And man. It's a lot of exciting stuff in that regard, but
that's awesome.
Hunting and music,
I love that. And I got a couple questions for you. Like I have a fire match you kind of hot.
I like it.
Craziest thing that ever happened during a live show. What's the craziest thing you've ever witnessed or had happen to you at a live show?
Okay. I was playing at a tiny town in Colorado. I used to live out in the mountains of Colorado and Guffey, Colorado. Not to call you out, amazing town, but little bar there. And I'm playing and there's the bar right in front of me and people are kind of facing the music, but there's TVs behind the bar. And so I'm seeing the TVs as I'm performing and then I see porn on the TV. I'm like, this is public. I mean, it's Guffey, Colorado. It's middle of nowhere, but it's kind of counts as public. And I was just like, man, it threw me off. I'm like, you know, trying to sing a song and then there's, you know, porn on the TV. So I would say that's probably the craziest thing.
Something tells me there's a song to be written about that in there somewhere.
Yeah, it would probably work decently for a Texas country song.
Hilarious. I don't know. Are you familiar with the old artist Jim Croce from the 60s, 70s?
Amazing.
So a lot of his songs came from experiences that he had doing whatever. Are you familiar with his song Roller Derby Queen?
I'm sure I've heard it before. I never remember the names of the songs. I just kind of
listen. That song came from, he was doing a show and before he really became big and started playing like these bigger venues, he would just be going around playing shows at whatever bars would let him play. And he said he did this show one time and it was one of those bars that were like so crazy. He was behind like a fence, like the stage was like behind a fence because they didn't want people throwing shit at the people on the stage. So he said, you know, they had the TVs playing or whatever. And he finished his show and he went to go put his coat on. And he like meets this woman. And he starts talking to her. He said, you know, she was just this big, you know, this big brawling looking woman, just like, you know, could fend for herself or whatever. And it turns out she was a roller derby person. Like her sport was roller derby. And he's like, oh my God. And he starts taking his jacket off and like set it up. And right there on the spot, he wrote a song. And he's like, you know, it was even the story just kept getting better and better because her husband was a state trooper. So like the whole song was, dude, it's like hilarious.
Oh, that's good. I got to listen to that after this.
Yeah. And the cool thing about Jim is when you listen to his live albums, the few that he had from before, you know, the plane crash and everything, he tells the stories of some of the songs right before he plays the song. So like when he's playing live, you get the context of where it came from and then he plays it. So you could have like the full story going in your head, which is like awesome versus people like the Eagles, right? Who someone asked Don Henley one time, what's the song Hotel California about? And he said, if I need to tell you, I wouldn't have wrote it in the first place. It's meant for you to have it be whatever you want. You know, so it was like really cool to see two different sides of the spectrum where it's like on one side, it's like, yeah, I'll tell you where the story came from. And on the other one, it's like, it came from wherever you want. Cause that's the purpose of music. You know,
I love that too. Cause there's like, that's songwriting. Like you can go down those two different routes. As you know, I know that you think about it probably in the same way as me, cause I know you're a musician too. But when I write, you know, I've gotten more in love with the less esoteric stuff, which is like the let it be your own imagination, and more with like the songwriting, that's why I love country, because you can write as factually as you want about an exact specific thing, or you can, you know, make it a little bit more up to the listener's imagination.
I like
both styles a lot.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, what's really cool about country is like you can kind of write about whatever you want.
Yeah.
And as long as you tell a story, which I love songs that tell stories. I mean, that's like half of country music, if not more, you know, and I love the ones like you listen to people like Brad Paisley or Zac Brown, country artists that aren't just singing about beer, trucks and dogs. You know what I mean? Like not to sound like an ass, but like, sound like, and I love those songs. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But it's really nice to hear the other side of that. Like people who can write about a story and turn it into something that people want to hear. Like that to me is just the epitome of music.
Yeah, there's a time and a place and a listener for every different style and a song out there.
100%. Where is your favorite place that you've ever played?
Oh, man. I don't know. I'm probably going to forget one. I mean, I like playing. Right now, I like playing at the Gin. It's a little bar down the road. Everybody, it's a really cool atmosphere in Prosper, Texas. I like playing at the Rustic, which is kind of downtown Dallas. It's more of a music venue. And I just like going to new towns oftentimes. Like it might not be even about the venue. It's like I get to go to a new town. I played in New Braunfels the other night and God, coolest little town in Texas. It's like an old German settlement town. So super old. The streets are terrible, but awesome, of like, you know, cobblestone, and they're always getting flooded when it rains like half an inch, and a couple rivers that go through there. Just a badass town. So I like the fact that music kind of gives me an excuse to travel.
Kind of like, takes you places.
Kind of like hunting too.
Yeah. All right. Now, like, now the toughest question of the night for you. If you had to pick one and you couldn't do the other for the rest of your life, music or hunting?
I've thought about this in my head a lot. It's a terrible question. It's an awful question.
It really is. Cause like, it's like, which arm you want to chop off, you know?
Yeah. It's like, it's kind of like, do you want to, like, would you choose being blind, or would you choose, you know, not being able to hear anymore or something?
Mm-hmm.
Man, I'm leaning towards saying that I would give up music over hunting.
Mm-hmm.
But that's fair. It's hard to say that, but it's just, they're both do their thing, and it's like, they're both therapeutic. They're both, I don't know, man. I don't know. I think I just like, I like that. I would hate to give up hunting, cause it's like this solitary thing that I can do, and music so public. I mean, oftentimes public, but man, I wouldn't want to give up that solitary, like, me time of hunting. Unless maybe, you know, you were like, well, you can still go out in the woods and do photography or something. Maybe then it would be a different answer. I'd have to ask a lot of specific questions, you know. Is it like, I can never touch an instrument again, or I can never touch a bow again? It'd be tough.
That's fair. But look at it like this, too. I mean, you put a mouth call in, you can make some music in the woods any day you want.
Oh, yeah. It's about to be, you know, turkey season, about to be firing them up. Except,
dude, I don't know if you saw the picture I posted this afternoon, but I was driving down. So when I got home from, like, where we live, we don't have a garbage program. So, but we have a community dump. So we could just go to the center of the community, dump the trash, and you go whenever you want, as long as it's within hours.
And the bears aren't there.
I mean, maybe, maybe not. But it's always like, we don't have that many bear in the community. Like, there's one or two here or there, but like, no, they don't really bother us. But I was driving there today after work to go drop off the trash. And as I'm driving through, dude, I saw the largest flock of turkey I've ever seen in my life. And it's on this private property that's literally less than a mile away from my house. I've never seen a single tree stand there. And I'm going to go knock on some doors and see if I can go hunt there.
I love it.
On the way there, I took a video, and on the way back, I took another one. I ended up posting it on Instagram today. Dude, this one turkey had like a 7-8 inch long beard. Dude, it got me fired up. And I've never turkey hunted before, but I want to get into it this year. And Now I'm like starting to pay attention to where they are and like, how do they interact with each other, and kind of, you know what I mean? So I'm ready. And especially if I can get it done right outside my house.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that'd be awesome.
Because you could go hunt in the morning and then get to work or whatever, probably. Because, I mean, a good hour long turkey hunt right at daylight is still a great, worthwhile time.
Yeah. Well, for me, unfortunately, I have to leave before the sun comes up to get to work on time. So weekday wouldn't be good, but weekend wouldn't be bad. And the biggest thing for me is, like, I don't mind going hunting, getting out of the woods in the dark, but, you know, sometimes my wife wants me home a little earlier than I get home. And when it gets dark, like before the clocks change and it's not dark till like, say, 7:30, 8 o'clock, and then I have an hour ride home, and I don't get home till like 9. I got to be out of the house by 5 o'clock in the morning the next day. It's like, that gets a little rough. But anyway, before we get, we're about to get into the hunting stuff. I really want to hear about how you got into the hunting and stuff. I know we touched on this. I don't know the word I'm looking for, but for the listeners, we actually recorded this exact podcast a week ago, and we ended up with like some pretty bad audio issues and video issues, and we decided to just re-record it. So we're going to try to make the magic happen again. And I heard some of your story, but we ended up running so long that we never got to the whole thing. And I felt pretty bad because we never got to hear your story about the music. So before we get into the hunting, I want to hear, if you don't mind, just how did you get into the music? What is it about the music that does it for you? And what was it that made you decide, like, you know, I'm going to do this as a career?
Yeah, great question. So I grew up on a farm, middle of nowhere, South Carolina. And like, growing up, parents were like, you got to take a musical instrument. It's just kind of like another school subject, so to speak. So you choose an instrument, and you go take lessons once a week. And I chose violin at first, fiddle. He moved. So then I was stuck with piano. So I was playing piano for like 5 years, you know, from like 7 years old till whatever, 12 or something. And then my brother got a guitar, and then I just started getting infatuated with, like, you know, like rock music, guitar goes hand in hand. And I would like be like, I'm drawn to the guitar. So when my brother would go to work, because he's my older brother, he'd go to work and I would steal his guitar and like taught myself how to play guitar. And then it was just like, hey, I'm playing guitar now, so screw piano. Even though piano is super cool now. It's awesome, actually. Mm-hmm. But that's how I kind of got down the guitar route. And as soon as I could learn three chords, I was like, you know, doing half-assed recordings and like playing lead over it. And I got a loop pedal. And so just infatuated with a guitar, and always fancied myself like a guitar player at the time because I couldn't sing. And then, but still wrote songs. I mean, I wrote songs for 10 years and played for 10 years without playing in front of anybody until I moved to Colorado and started doing open mics. And by that time I was like, you know, had some songs I like playing under my belt, still never played in front of anybody. And then it was, yeah, once I got the open mic thing, it turned into a band, and it was like, hey, you know, this is freaking awesome. And I can kind of do it well enough to get by. And then just kind of snowballs, like with anything, you practice and you get better. So eventually right. It's like, hey, you know, I can do this thing. And then I always put it in the background as a career, I think, just because of the way I grew up and the people I was around. Like, I don't know anybody who did that as a career. And it wasn't like, I grew up in kind of a strict family, so that type of music wasn't exactly encouraged. And so, yeah, it really took me until I was like older to kind of just do my own thing with it and not worry about that and be public with it. So, yeah, I was like 22 before I played and sang in front of people.
Okay.
And then
go ahead.
And then it just, I mean, just through the course of deciding to play more here in the last couple of years, connections and like staying busy playing gigs just turned into enough money to pay the bills. And I was like, okay, well then why would I not put more effort and focus into that? So that's how I think I've been full time for like 3 or 4 months now.
I love that. And in talking to you for the last couple of weeks, it seems like you have that personality of like, yeah, man, whatever. Like, I'll go play live. Like, oh, yeah, you want to hang out? Like, cool, let's hang out. You know what I mean? Like, I wouldn't strike you as somebody who had fear of playing in front of people, you know? But it's amazing how, you know, sitting there and listening, your story is so similar to mine. Like, yeah. So similar. I have been playing instruments and singing since I was in third grade. I mean, I grew up singing Frank Sinatra in the shower because that's all my dad listened to. My grandparents listened to like Frank Sinatra and Michael Bublé and all those guys. And then my dad would listen to like the Beach Boys and the Beatles and Creedence. And then I found Guns N' Roses and I was like, oh my, this is awesome.
Yeah.
You know, and then third grade, I started when I went to school in third grade, it was the first year you were allowed to play an instrument, but you had to pick a string instrument to start. So the first instrument I learned was violin. I started playing it and like it was all right, but I was like, my neck hurt and I didn't want to deal with that, you know. So the next year you were allowed to it opened up to more options. You could pick brass instruments, you could play drums. I really wanted to play drums. I love holding a beat. Like I love, like I'm always tapping my feet. I got ADHD, you know, so like to slam around on the drums would have been perfect.
Yeah.
So I go home and I'm like, Dad, guess what, I signed up to play drums. And my mom goes, you're gonna play drums? My dad goes, are you crazy? And, you know, I told you earlier, my dad is an accountant and he worked for a firm and then he had his own clients on the side. So he'd have people come to the house during tax season. And my mom was like, you think you're going to play drums when your dad's got clients? I was like, are you crazy? And she's like, your brother, we're not buying you a drum set. Your brother's got a trumpet sitting in the closet. He doesn't play it anymore. Why don't you play? And I was like, all right, fine. You know, so I picked up trumpet. Now, the thing is, I come from a musical family. My grandfather rode trucks like to make a living. And then he also played in a band. They'd go and play at like weddings and venues and like, you know, smaller stuff where, you know, they'd make enough money. And he was the drummer in the band. So I think that's kind of where like I wanted to play drums growing up. And then my dad played with the band. You know, he wasn't like a steady, but he'd fill in for people or, you know, just show up and play with them every now and then. And my uncle, my dad's brother, unfortunately, we don't talk to him anymore, but he was the most talented out of all of us. He played in the army band as a trumpeter. And then he ended up making a professional career out of it. He's a music teacher and he played music for Alicia Keys. Like back in the day, you could see him playing live on TV. Oh, and it was like, it was so cool. So when I picked up the trumpet, it was almost like natural when I started playing instruments. And I get to seventh grade. So now I've been playing from fourth to seventh grade. And I didn't practice a whole lot. Honestly, it came naturally to me. I won't lie. But when I got to music class, I never really learned how to read music. Like, I knew how to read music, but I wasn't really, you know. So I asked the kid how to play a note one time. My teacher was like, you know what? If you practice at home more often, you'd know how to play that note. And I was like, yep, I'm done with this shit. I quit the next day and I never played for the school again. Now, you know, like, that's seventh grade. And then fast forward to
that's
like
a drummer's attitude right there.
100%. I told, dude, I'm telling you, I was born to be a drummer and I missed my call in my life. But I get to high school and I'm like, I miss playing an instrument. So I picked up a guitar. I ended up doing yard work. My dad like bought me my first guitar kit. And everything I know about guitar, I taught myself. YouTube, videos, books and stuff. I got three lessons because someone bought them for me for Christmas, like my second year. And then from there, I just played myself. But very similar to you, I would never play in front of people. I would never sing in front of anybody. It was always closed off in my bedroom. If people were home, I wasn't singing type of deal. You know what I mean? And then I get to college. I'm 22 years old and I'm playing guitar in my bedroom with the door closed. And we lived in like, it was technically off campus, but it was owned by the college. And we lived in this place where it was like four of us in one unit. And then we had four people in the unit next to us and across from us or whatever. I'm sitting in my room playing guitar one day and my buddy brings his friend over to like cut his hair. And he goes, he like stops the buzzer and he's like, dude, who's playing Red Hot Chili Peppers instrumental right now? And he's like, that's not an instrumental, dude. Like, that's my roommate. He goes, what? He like stopped the buzzer, left the bathroom, came and sat on my bed and just starts freestyling. Never met this kid a day in my life. Fast forward, whatever, like a year passes. We play all the time. We're writing music. We're like having a good time. That's and he awesome. Goes, and he fucking puts me on the spot one day. We're at a fucking party. We're having a party at his house. And he's like, yo, this kid can shred and he can sing. And I was like, yo, you're not doing this to me right now. He goes, no, you're on the hot seat. Let's go. So I pull it out and I start playing Under the Bridge. And from that point on, I was like, all right, this is cool. And then we end up going to this bar in town called Sarah Street Bar and Grill in East Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania. And he called me up on the stage. Like he was on stage doing his thing. And he's like, yeah, my buddy's going to come and play with me. I was like, what? So he like, I put me on the spot. I couldn't say no. And the second I started playing, I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And from that point on, I played any open mic I could find. And it was amazing. You know? So like our stories are so similar.
So similar.
I can't believe that.
That is so similar. And it makes me want to give a shout out to like some of the unsung heroes who like put us on the spot to do things that we wouldn't otherwise do on our own. Mm-hmm. And like there's people like that all along the way and you kind of forget maybe, but like, man, they made such a difference in pushing us to do something or giving us that little spark of like doing it in front of people, which then motivates you to do it, practice more and put yourself out there more. I used to tell myself like my bar, because I was like, I'll do it. I like it. I like to do it. The only way I could mentally cope with doing it in the early days was like, and even still now, it's like, I'm like, as long as I'm not the worst person, like that's my bar. It's like, as long as I'm not the worst person to sing in front of people, I'm probably not the worst person these people have ever heard. Like somebody else has been worse than me. That's my like, okay, it's all good. Like, I'm just going to go do my thing best as I can.
I just need a little buzz, man. You get me in front of people. You give me a couple beers. You give me a good buzz. Like I'm hopping on. There's no like, but I remember I was in college and we used to go to like the bars with my friends and his parents or whatever. And they like, we'd go to live shows, like people that they knew. Dude, I got so wasted at the bar one night. I jumped up and I started singing like, I'll get knocked down. But I just literally jumped up and like pulled the mic out of the guy's hand. I'm like, whatever, you know, it was a good time. Yeah. But yeah, so. If you're anything like me, you love to customize your bow while always making sure everything is just spot on. That's why I trust Anthony and Chris over at Big D Custom Pro Shop. They're located on Route 15 in Lake Apacon, New Jersey, and they have everything you need to tune your bow. And I promise you, you're going to leave there with a smile on your face. So, if you live in northern New Jersey, give my boy Big D a shout for all your archery needs. When I head out to the woods, I have to know that I have the best performing equipment that I can afford. So that way I'm the only variable that I have to worry about. That's why I trust FireKnock products for all my arrow and bow accessory needs. From aero components to bow accessories like stabilizers and aero rests, they have what you need. Dorge won't put anything on the market if it doesn't perform 50% better than what's already out there. So head on over to fireknock.com today to see what they're all about. Now that we got into the, we've spoken about the music thing, and I think there's a lot of similarities in there that also relate to hunting.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of people have taught themselves how to hunt, but a lot of other people, you know, grew up in a family where it was kind of just nurtured and it grew within them, you know? And from what I recall, I think that that was somewhat similar to your upbringing, right? You had like, a, I think you said you had some private property. You lived on a farm in South
Carolina. That's right. Yeah. We did talk about that a little.
Yeah. So, why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about how you got into hunting? I know you said you grew up in like a hunting family, but you know, your story was a little different. You were like pigeonholed into like this one way of hunting for like the longest amount of time. So why don't you go ahead and tell the listeners about that a little bit?
Yeah. So I grew up on 53 acres in South Carolina, and my dad hunted and my family hunted, you know, so it was just pretty natural. But I mean, pretty early on, I started hunting by myself. And right about that time, maybe like 12 years old is when kind of my dad kind of got out of it. It's like, okay, you're safe enough to use a rifle on your own or whatever, which is kind of crazy thinking back. But like 12-year-old kids back then are built different.
Yeah.
Especially when you're a farm kid. Like, I mean, I was in the, go walk around the woods by myself with a shotgun at 9 years old and everybody completely mm-hmm. trusted me, like, which is crazy, sure. Probably crazy for a 9-year-old nowadays. And most were in the country. But yeah, so once I was kind of on my own, I think my dad got out of it. It wasn't like, I mean, I was the guy who hunted. Like my brother was doing school, college, whatever. And I was like, so I was kind of on my own, honestly, even though it was very like encouraged and accepted. And I could just walk out the back door, go down the woods and hunt. But it was like 30 acres of pasture, 20 acres of woods. It was like two family groups of does, the same ones. Like we got to know each other really well. I overhunted the shit out of it. You know, I'm like walk down there every day, try different angles of approach and everything. Didn't know shit about the wind. Like didn't care. Know that it was a big deal until, you know, I like started to pick up on it reading in like old Field and Stream magazines. Remember how they'd have the mm-hmm. articles with the picture magazines. Diagrams?
Imagine having to read magazines today. Imagine people having to learn how to hunt just from reading magazines today. Sorry, brutal. I didn't mean to cut you off there, but yeah, the magazines. Like, and I actually still read. I read books still. Like, I have like how to hunt topographic maps and stuff. Like, I hate reading, but I love reading about hunting.
I agree
hate reading,
with that.
But I love hunting reading.
Yeah. And I think I still like at my parents' house back home still is a stack of like 30 Field and Stream magazines that I just devoured. Like, that's how I learned to hunt, even though, you know, you're hunting super capped when you're stuck on a small acreage that's the same setup. Like, just your hunting knowledge skyrockets as soon as you decide to go hunt public land on thousands of acres in all sorts of different places. But yeah, early days was like small private farm, not knowing anything about it. I think we talked about this actually. It was like, don't shoot does, like let your first deer be a buck. And so it was like hunted for forever, like two seasons with a rifle. I think I shot my first buck at like 14 by myself out of a climber on the neighbor's property that I had permission on, I thought at the time. And then, that's a whole long story. But and then I got into bow hunting. I think I remember telling you this now, but I went to visit a family friend in Virginia because they had like 200 acres and mm-hmm. they had big deer. And I was like, oh, I got to go. It's shotgun only, I think. At least I was hunting with a shotgun at the time. And I go up there and they got a kid my age, you know, like one of their sons is my age and we're going to do the hunting thing. And so, I mean, I'm obsessed. So I'm out there every morning hunting, but he's hunting with a bow, come to find out, because he had a felony charge and he wasn't allowed to have a firearm. But during the day, we'd like shoot his bow. And I was like, this is the freaking coolest thing ever. Like, you mean I can kill a deer with a freaking bow, an arrow, like an Indian? Like, I read like every Louis L'Amour book, every Zane Grey book, like, mm-hmm. and Cowboys and Indians is my shit, dude. Love Cowboys and Indians. So I just got obsessed with the bow and I was like, can I hunt with the bow? You know, cause I could hit the milk jug at 20 yards or whatever. And so we just traded weapons and it was like, if you shot, If he shot something with a shotgun, I would say I shot it. If I shot something with a bow, he'd say he shot it, you know, because he wasn't allowed to have a gun. And then as soon as I got back from that trip, and we never killed anything, but as soon as I got back from that trip, I was like, I need a bow immediately. Like, that's all I want for Christmas. So my dad got me a bow for Christmas that year. I still remember the guy who set me up with it, and I've never seen him since then, but like, I want to find that guy and be like, dude, thank you for like setting me up with my first PSE bow a million years ago. I want to say his name was Brian Woody, but that's maybe wrong. But
you still have that bow? You still have that first bow?
No, I sold it. No.
Okay.
I still got my first guitar that I ever bought, though, at 15 years old with my own money. Yep.
I'm really upset I sold my first bow. I think I traded my first guitar to someone for something else. And at the time, I didn't care about it. And honestly, now, the fact that it was my first guitar, I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
What I do care about is it was like one of the cheaper Strats. But what I wanted to do, and I've never had the money to buy the guitar and all the parts to do it since, but I always wanted to convert a Strat into a 12 string. And you could buy your own 12 string, you know, you can drill the holes into it to get like your own 12 string, you know, tuners. And then, you know, all you have to do is get the special bridge that is made for the 12 string. And then the rest is gold. I mean, I still have somewhere. So I don't have it in here with me today, but the last time we were recording, I had my Strat in the background. I stripped the stock pickups out of that Strat and I replaced them with Lace Sensor pickups, the exact same pickups that are in the Eric Clapton signature Strat. And then I did like a whole bunch of upgrades. Like I upgraded the capacitors. This is supposed to be a hunting podcast. What are we doing? But I stripped like everything, the capacitors, the tuners, the bridge, the string nut at the top. Like I completely upgraded that guitar and I love it. But now I have all the parts to get started. Like I have decent quality pickups to throw on another guitar. So someday I hope to make like a 12 string and just have something to mess around with. And honestly, it's only for two reasons. One, Hotel California. Two, Over the Hills and Far Away. Led Zeppelin.
Yes. Yes. That's the first time I could put my hands on a 12 string guitar, like at an acoustic shop or whatever. I was like, you know, like playing that.
Yeah, exactly.
I play this on a 6 string, but now I get to play it on a 12 string and it sounds awesome.
And then you go to play you go to play Stairway to Heaven. And all of a sudden they turn all the amps off, lights turn off. They're like, yeah, you got to go.
Right.
So all right, man. So you were hunting in South Carolina. And looking back, what's kind of cool is like if you knew what you know now back then, you could have done so much damage on a property like that, because obviously the deer want to be in the pastures. Where the deer are going to be during the day, they're going to be, if they're on your property, they're going to be in the woodlot. They're not going to be hanging out in the middle of the pastures and the fields. You know what I mean? So like knowing, if you knew that, then you could have done so well just by like, all right, I don't need to hunt every day. I just need to hunt the days that I know that they're going to be in that patch.
Yeah.
You know, have you ever gone back to hunt there again? Like, do your parents still have the farm?
Oh yeah. So now my deer knowledge and my knowledge of the property, combining those two things, it's like you could just dial it in. I mean, there's not big bucks there, and they're there 2 weeks of the year during the rut is when they'll come out of the thick neighbors and come over there. But like my nephew got his first buck there over Thanksgiving. That's so awesome. We always go back for Thanksgiving and we make sure we get in a couple of days of hunting, and it's kind of dedicated to the nephews now. Like, let's get them their first deer. And I got to hunt with them last season. It was cool. But I told my brother, I was like, because he lives still around there, I was like, if you go sit here with Isaiah, I was like, you're gonna kill a buck. Like, he's going to come out of that. Like, this is the time of year where it happens. Nobody's been messing around in that area of the property for a couple weeks. Like, and sure enough, I get a text, you know, right at dark, buck down, like his first buck. And we got to all clean it together and, you know, got blood on his face, and he got to, you know, partake in that little rite of passage into manhood. It was just freaking that's cool awesome. Because, I mean, that's the same property his dad shot his first deer on however many years ago. And
yeah,
I shot my first deer on. And so it's cool. But yeah,
I love that.
It's such a cool, like, full circle thing for generational hunters. But yeah, the property itself it doesn't interest me that much in hunting other than the nostalgia and more just putting my nephews on it. Cause I mean, there's not like, yeah, I just wouldn't be that interested in hunting it for like bucks these days, but it's just fun to sit in those woods I sat in when I was, you know, 7, 10.
Yeah. Or it's like, you know, I need some meat. I'm gonna go drop a doe for the night. You know what I mean?
Totally.
Now, what's kind of awesome is, like, I feel like every family has their rite of passage thing, right? Like, you do the blood on the face or whatever. And, like, they used to tell, like, when I was a kid, and they never made me do it. Like, they stopped me before they made me do it. But they were like, you got to eat one of the nuts. I was like, yeah. Yeah, they're like, yeah, you got to cut a testicle off and eat it. I was like, absolutely not.
No.
And they're like, then you're never coming back again. I'm like, okay. And they're like, no, because you're not going to do that.
Yeah.
I feel like everyone's got something, you know, whether it's you have to gut it yourself, and, like, you know what I mean, or, like, you know, we'll help you, but, you know, you got to be the one to do
yes.
it, or, like, whatever the case is, a certain type of picture, or a picture in front of a certain tree, or, like, you know what I mean. And that's so cool, because, like you're saying, like you just said it right now, you could pass that down generation to generation. And I'm now fortunate enough where our family, for the first time, has that opportunity to have those experiences, because my parents bought a piece of property in New York like 4 years ago now. This will be our fifth hunting season coming up. We just finished our fourth hunting season, and we're in the process of getting it ready. You know, I've become, you know, somewhat of a property manager. And from that alone, a lot of what I do today has come from the opportunities that have come from that property. Like, I wouldn't have this podcast right now if it wasn't for everything I did for the property. I wouldn't have, like, my forest management business on the side if it wasn't for us having this property, you know? So now my thing is, like, when we got the property, it was rough. And I don't mean rough like there weren't deer there and we still have this problem, but it was like, there's no cover. You can literally see across the woods. Where there is cover is on the road. So when you go to access the property, the deer know you're there,
mm-hmm.
you know? And it's really the earlier in the season, the better. Because as the season, like when the trees are still leafed out, it's decent hunting. So I say all that to say, my oldest niece, the oldest kid in our family, is 7 going on 8. She'll be 8 in April. She's not allowed to hunt until she's 13 years old in New York. So I got this timeline in my head, like, hunting better be better 5 years from now. Because, like, for me, like, yeah, I want to shoot a deer, and I'd like to shoot a nice buck on our property. But more importantly, I want this to be ready for them, because we all know, everyone who hunts, if you can get a kid out and have some kind of success the first couple times that they go out, they're hooked for life. And if they're not, then it's not something that they would have ever been into in the first place.
Well, yeah.
You know what I mean? And now she has a younger sister who's 2 years old. So I have an 8-year-old niece and a 2-going-on-3-year-old niece. And we have our first baby on the way. She's due in April. You know, so 13 years from now, this property hopefully is going to be booming. We've started putting in some food plots. We have, like, this whole management plan laid out, where we're going to have a harvester come in and pretty much reset our forest. If it's not a tree that's perfect, it's going. So, like, we're literally going to do like a 75-80% canopy opening. We're going to open up the sun to the forest floor.
Love it.
We're going to kill everything that we don't want or that's going to stop the trees from growing. And then through that, we're going to be able to put in some food plots and some bedding areas. And then as the forest starts to grow back, I'm going to put in my own travel corridors, you know, like, I have this crazy idea, and I don't even know if it's going to work, but I imagine it would. Deer go from bedding to food, food to bedding, bedding to water, water to food, food to water. That's their life.
Yeah.
Bedding, food, water, fuck. Bedding, food, water, fuck. That's their life. So my thing is, there's some
safety thrown in there.
Exactly. You know, so, like, my goal is to create these travel corridors that go between the bedding and the food, food to bedding, corridors that come off the corridors. And I'm simply going to do that by, once the woods get cleared out, we're pretty much going to have, a reset forest. So as that forest is coming back, I'm going to go through with like herbicides and stuff, and I'm going to kill 1.5 foot wide paths from where, you know, from the bed to the water, whatever. And then as those trees start coming in, I'm going to hinge cut them. So that way I've created the corridor that's clear for them to walk. And then by hinge cutting the trees, I give them the cover of safety, or the safety of cover, but also an escape route. So, like, my long-term plan is to literally force the deer to move through the property the way I want to. Like, literally, like, I'm putting a house together or constructing a house.
That's so fun. Like, that's one of my goals long-term. I mean, I'm really, really eaten up with public land hunting, like, fully happy with it these days. But I think a long-term goal would be to be where I've got a property where I can do exactly that. Cause it's just so fun to be able to manage the deer. And I used to do that on my parents' property to my limited ability and degree. Like I put in food plots, right? And I got the tractor and like dished food plots, put clover plots up there. So I got a little taste of that, but it'd be fun to do the real deal like you're doing. That sounds awesome. Yeah.
And I mean, and it is fun. I've made mistakes along the way, but the hardest thing I found is it's really hard to get help, you know, and we have 130 acres. So it's
a lot of work.
It is. So you gotta, you know, prioritize. So like my thing is knowing that we're having the harvest coming through, I have to kill everything first. Like the biggest thing is the ferns. When you have the ferns growing up, they leaf out really quickly early season and they shade out anything that's growing in. So they can't grow. So if I don't kill the ferns off, they're pretty much going to take over the property and we're just either going to have no trees or the ones that do come in are going to be shade tolerant trees, which are typically your non-desirable species of trees. So that, you know, that's besides the point. But, you know, you're welcome to come and join us anytime you like. You want to come on up and hang out for a weekend, you know, I'll tell my family, hey, I'm signing out the cabin for the weekend. We're having a boys weekend.
Dude, that'd be awesome. We could play some music, write some
music.
That's
what I'm saying. Dude,
I missed on the last talk that you played guitar. So, I mean, even easier. Some shredding and.
We'll shred a little bit, drink a little bit. We have my father-in-law is a professional barbecuer. When I say professional barbecuer, like he's got his own company, his own food truck, but he's also a mechanic. So like that's his side gig. And then he competes in like these world competitions and all these competitions all over the place. He won best burger in the world 2 years ago.
Are you so kidding me? That's enough reason to come up there all by itself.
Exactly.
Get some of that burger and barbecue.
Exactly. Now, when we had our when we were getting married, my bachelor party was essentially a family pheasant hunt on a pheasant preserve. Like they rented out, like we went 13 of us or 15 of us or something. We split up into four groups. Each of us had two dogs that they rented or whatever. My dog, go figure, that weekend, he ended up coming down, like he ate something he shouldn't have or whatever. He ended up with gastroenteritis or whatever. It was bad, like bad. Man. So yeah, but I say all that to say that weekend that we had the bachelor party, my father-in-law brought up literally a pig roasting smoker, massive smoker. It's like 6 feet across. So whenever the boys come up, we have big family events or whatever, we pop that top off, we smoke whatever man. We want. And I know I might get some flack for this on the podcast. I'm gonna say it anyway. One of these days, I'm probably gonna take a younger deer and just do a full deer smoke the same way you would with like a pig or something.
Why not?
I'm really looking
absolutely
forward to that. I'm just not going to take it from our property. I won't shoot a young deer on our property because I'm managing it. But like, if I could take one in PA or something and like bring it over to the cabin, like that would be awesome. Like I'm really looking forward to it.
Anytime you're like, I love experimenting with cooking deer different ways. And I mean, that's part of the whole full circle fun of hunting is like, it's not just the killing part, right? It's learning how to get close enough to kill them with a bow or whatever you're using. And then learning how to clean them, process them yourself, and then what am I like the whole time you're doing that, you're thinking, you know, what recipe do I want to use for the front shoulder or the back roast, or like every roast has a specific recipe. I mean, you could spend a lifetime learning how to do different recipes for deer. It's like it's a never-ending amazing fun full circle. It just keeps going. Like, oh, like say you find out a good recipe with one roast, you're like, well, I only had two. They're out. I cannot wait to kill another deer next year. So
that's what
I can
I'm saying.
Do this recipe again. You know, it's like
exactly. Now the cool thing was with my father-in-law being the barbecuer that he is, he fucked up a backstrap like 2 years ago.
Yeah,
because he thought it was supposed to be 160, and it comes off the grill, and I cut into it. I was like, "You're fired." I was like, "You can cook anything else you want except deer meat for the rest of forever."
60. I mean, that seems like a rookie mistake. No offense.
That's what I said. I said, "What is this, a rookie of the week? Like, what's going on?" But you know, when I cook deer meat, 120, it's coming off the grill. Even if it's 118, I'll pull it off slightly early. But I do a reverse sear. So I'll smoke like for example, I'm doing a backstrap or like a tenderloin or something. I'll smoke it at like 86 degrees, bump it up to like 180 halfway through, let it just slow cook through. And when it hits 120, I slam it on a hot pan and just hit each side 4 seconds on every edge, seal that in. Love the sound. seal that in. And then from there, like, man, it's just,
oh, makes me hungry.
It's amazing. Bacon wrap. You ever have bacon wrapped deer meat?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Bacon, dude, that, like, my life changed when I learned how to do that. I was trying to make a roast one day, and everyone knows roasts are one of the hardest things to keep juicy and tender. Mm-hmm. They dry out very easily. Well, I wrapped it in bacon, like, you literally couldn't see a single piece of meat, and I threw it in the oven and just let it slow cook in the oven. And from that point on, cooking any meat wrapped in bacon is like my favorite thing to do.
Oh yeah.
The only problem is you got to use a whole freaking package of bacon every time you cook it, you know? So it's like, but that's all right. So you did your hunting in South Carolina. You grew up, you got your feet wet in South Carolina. You ended up going to Colorado before Texas, right? Like, from South Carolina, you hit Colorado.
Yes, sir.
And you did some elk hunting there for the first time, or had you elk hunted there before that? Have you elk hunted prior to that?
First time, man. I literally remember texting my buddy from a magazine article I read about elk hunting in Colorado, and that you can just buy a tag and go out there and hunt. And that idea kind of percolated in my mind before I'd ever moved. And I was like, I remember texting my hunting buddy, be like, we can, like, go to Colorado and hunt elk. Like, we can just do it. For some reason, I didn't know that, you know,
mm-hmm.
16, 17 years old, maybe. And no, I was probably older than that. But, you know, we didn't have, like, or at least I didn't have, like, internet and podcasts and all these different things to, in Instagram, to, like, expose you to, like, the opportunities out there. So I found out about it in a magazine. But when we moved to Colorado, I mean, that was, like, top of mind. I was like, I'm going to elk hunt. And so, like, the second I got there, I started driving around looking for elk, like, and I found them. And then I was at a bar, go figure, and I was talking about elk hunting. And I was like, talking to this old guy who elk hunted. He's like, oh, you elk hunt? I'm like, well, I've never done it before, but I'm gonna. And I was like, I actually drove up today and saw all these elk at blah, blah, blah. I won't say the name right now. And he goes, this is such a, like, hunters will understand this. He's like, shh. Cause I said that name out loud, and, like,
out loud. Yeah.
And it was, like, one of his spots that he knew was, like, dynamite. And so I just stumbled into this from, like, pre-scouting from the road. And he was like, don't tell anybody that. He's like, I'll take you out this year.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And so I drew a different unit, didn't have any success, didn't know what I was doing at all. And I phoned him up that season. I was like, hey, we'd see each other at the bar at, like, open mics and stuff. It was, like, the same open mic where I first mm-hmm. started playing. And he was like, well, come hunting with me. He's like, we'll find elk. And okay. So I was like, okay, because that's way better than walking around the mountains not seeing shit and not knowing what I'm – knowing that I don't know what I'm doing and just feeling like I'm wasting my time almost. Mm-hmm. So I go hunting with him, and we like, have elk encounters, like, bugling. Like, I saw, like, a 4x4, and I was like, this is amazing. Like, I just had an elk encounter, and I was –
that sounds incredible.
I was already hooked mentally, but, like, then I was like, okay – I'm going with you, and just
forever.
Just, I got to learn more about it and get more interactions with elk. So he pretty much taught me how to elk hunt. The next few seasons, we just draw the same unit 481 in Colorado outside of Buena Vista. The dude's name's Al Bundy. Name's familiar.
No, I mean, the last name's familiar.
Yeah. Well, the first name is the same. Like, it's not the same Al Bundy, obviously, but
who's Al Bundy?
There was
the TV show,
yeah. Meet the
Ted Bundy was a
Ted Bundy killer. Was a serial killer. Al Bundy was the guy on the TV show.
Yes,
but yes. Not the same Al Bundy. But super cool dude. He actually makes instruments. So he out of like random stuff, he'll make instruments.
And really,
his son's a famous musician actually, and he'll play his instruments at his shows, like Trace Bundy.
No
so
shit.
He's got these guitars he makes. Like, he's very, like, DIY, can do anything guy. And he makes, like, he'll take an old antique sewing kit that he buys offline, and he just gets an idea in his head. He's like, I'm going to make a guitar out of that. And he buys all the different pieces online that in his mind make sense for it. And he builds a beautiful instrument that works perfectly. And he's got, like, I don't know, 10, probably around 10 instruments he's built.
Awesome.
and they're all unique. Like they're made out of some, you know, like one of them, I think it's a toilet bowl, sewing box, guitar box, like random stuff that turns into an awesome guitar.
So that's so cool because the dude from, now I might be getting the band wrong. I think it's the guitar player from, oh my God, why can't I remember now? I want to say it's either Journey or Queen, but it's like a big, one of the bigger guitar players. The guitar he played for most of his career, him and his father built.
That's cool.
And he still plays the original one. And he does it, whoever this guitar player is, he doesn't play with a pick. He plays with a dime or he plays with a British pound. I forget who it is, but he played that guitar for like just about his entire career. And it was the original one that they had built. So it's like, to me, that's incredible. I mean, I'm a big DIY guy. People have been listening to the podcast know that. I like building stuff on my own. I tried to build my own camera arm. Everything worked great, except I couldn't get the swivel to go smoothly, so that didn't exactly work. I basically bought a set of climbing sticks, and everything now on my climbing sticks are non-factory, except for the tube that came with it. Yeah. And the tube that it was on is the only thing on there that's factory. Because I just started mixing and matching and kind of doing my own thing. I mean, this office, last time we were on the podcast, this wasn't done yet. But it was all natural, like the natural pine. And I just went through here and burnt this last, like literally like 5 days ago. My brother was here this past weekend.
That looks awesome. But,
dude, go to the Instagram when you have a chance. I posted like a time lapse of me burning. It is the most therapeutic thing I've ever seen. I'm not just saying it because I did it, but like I'm burning it. And if you play it in slow motion, you see me. I tried to push the outlet back into the wall so I wouldn't burn the outlet. And I ended up touching the back of it and I got a freaking jolt, man. It woke me up.
My word.
Yeah. It woke me up, but it was just like, I love this kind of stuff. You know what I mean? Like I love building things. And now every time I walk in my office, it's like, I did that. Mm-hmm. But that translates back to like the whole forest management, property management type stuff. Like I said, when we got the property, don't get me wrong, there's great deer in the area. Like there's great stock, there's great genetics. I don't know what the hell they're eating because there's like nothing that I would consider highly nutritious for these deer where we are. But man, they're proving me wrong. But it's like the soil isn't the greatest and the hunting, like the further into the season you go, the worse it gets, you know? So it's like whatever happens from here on, that's on me. And to me, I absolutely love that. So anyway, you got into Colorado, you started going elk hunting. How long did it take you to shoot your first elk? Did you get one that first season you tried? Was it the second season?
Man, it is common with a lot of elk hunters, this what I'm going to say, but for archery elk. So for archery elk hunting, the statistics are 10% success ratio. So if you go for 10 years hunting, you'll get one elk, and that's either sex. That's not like big bull. It's wow. Like any elk, archery, public land, one every 10 years, 10% success ratio. But you have so many close calls in between that just hook you deeper and deeper and deeper. So it doesn't mean you don't like get into these crazy scenarios every season where you're like, you got a 300-inch bull that you're like in a calling battle with that you draw on. And so I didn't harvest my first elk for 7 or 8 seasons, but in between then I shot 2 other ones, which, you know, you never like the story of not finding one, but shot 2 other ones. I drew on 4 or 5 that we call them the elk gods. Like it's the most uncanny thing. It's like whenever a deer comes in range, it's like, I feel like I can always find a way to shoot at it, like pretty ethically. And elk just have these uncanny ways of like coming in and like covering their vitals, like looking out from behind a tree. Like just, it's unbelievable the things that happen where you, like I was 30 yards from a 350-inch bull and I finally thought I was going to get a shot. I mean, I've been hunting this thing for like 3 hours, like getting close, calling him in, him going away, you know, and comes into 30 yards, stops, and he's right behind like a bush that you just can't shoot. And everything else is open. It's like
everything else is every, yeah.
Give him a chip shot. And it's like those things happen almost every season. And so I never ever feel like, oh, I didn't get an elk, like it wasn't successful, because there are always so many close calls with elk, and it's just awesome hunting elk. But yeah, I finally shot. So I shot the cow. I shot the cow, and then the next year, I didn't shoot one. And then the next year, I shot my bull. And then, like, I'm feeling very confident about my elk hunting skills now. I like tip to anybody out there who wants to elk hunt. Just binge watch Paul Madel's elk nut material. Like, he knows how to talk to elk. And like Corey Jacobson and all those other guys are awesome too. But I just started getting really into like learning how to speak the language of elk. And that's so much more nuanced than like turkey hunting.
Mm-hmm.
Or turkey hunting, yeah, you're talking to them, but it's not as nuanced as elk.
It's a little different. See, what attracts me, or I've never been elk hunting. Honestly, I've never left the East Coast until 2 years ago, 3 years ago. My cousin decided to have a destination wedding in Mexico. So the first time I ever, like, I went to Canada when I was a kid, but I don't consider that leaving the country. Like, we were at Niagara Falls. Like, I could see America. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, so the first time I ever left the country was a few years ago. We went down to Mexico. That was great. Awesome experience. But the first time I ever left the East Coast in America was for my honeymoon. My wife and I, we, Old Dominion's one-man band ended up being our wedding song. You know, that was like, so like she walked down to a song that she wanted. Oh my God, she's going to kill me if I can't remember it. Frankie Valli, You're Just Too Good to Be True. Can't Take My Eyes Off of You.
Mm-hmm.
Right. She walked down to that. I walked down to you. Are you a Jack Johnson fan?
Oh yeah.
You know, Better Together.
Oh, yeah.
I found a piano like rendition of it. So we each walked down to our own song, but we walked out from the wedding to one man band. So now after the wedding, we're sitting there, we're trying to figure out where we're going to go on our honeymoon. And she's like, why don't we try to find somewhere cool that Old Dominion's playing? I was like, oh my God, what a great idea. So we end up looking it up. And long story short, we end up in Lake Tahoe. Dude, it was like one of the most incredible experiences of my life. But I will say this, Californians have zero regard for their life.
California is?
What's that?
You mean for how awesome California is as far as like beauty?
Well, no, California is beautiful, but I'm saying like, have you ever been to Lake Tahoe?
Yeah. Mountain biked around it and stuff. Yeah.
Okay. So when we landed in Sacramento. We stayed in Sacramento for three days. And on the third day, we ended up driving around to the east side, you know, driving up the east side into, we might have been in Nevada, right? Because Tahoe, the south end of Tahoe splits between Nevada and California, if I'm not mistaken.
I'm not sure.
Oh my God, I can't remember. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. But we end up, so we rented a Porsche, like a convertible Porsche stick shift. Dude, it was awesome. But anyway, so she was like, you know what? We rented this car. We have it. Why not go take a road trip? I was like, fuck it. So we end up driving up the whole eastern side of Lake Tahoe all the way up to like the Reno area and then turned around and came back down. On the way back, I refused to go in the right lane because you look over the mountain and it's just a straight 300-foot drop.
Oh, yeah.
And they have no guardrails. There's like, what? What?
In California.
Yeah. Well, I guess either California or Nevada. Because where we stayed at, we stayed at Valley State Line. We were in State Line. So if we walked in one direction, we were in California. And if we walked in the other direction, we were in Nevada. So it was a really cool experience. We really enjoyed it. And it's kind of crazy because like where we were, they were like, yeah, you know, we just had snow like 2 months ago. And I was like, this is California. What do you mean you have snow? You know, but like it was a really awesome experience. I would love to go back, but that's
you gotta go elk hunting, man.
I want to, dude, I want to go elk hunting so bad. Oh, that's what I was getting at. I'm sorry. So what attracts me to elk hunting is, to me, it's like the blend between deer hunting and pheasant hunting. I don't know if you've ever been upland bird hunting before.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But the way I see it, deer hunting is a time to be solitary. It's a time to be by yourself, you know, and it's this cat and mouse game. You know where the deer are coming from, you know where they're going, you know, and you're trying to beat them in their world, but you're by yourself. pheasant hunting is a little different. You go with a group. It's more of a camaraderie thing. You know, you're walking around, you're bullshitting, you know, who's smoking a cigarette, who's playing, you know, who's spitting sunflower seeds, who's playing music. And then a bird, you know, and you get to catch up with family. And then a bird gets up, and I'm fortunate enough to have a bird dog, you know, and, you know, he goes on point, and then everybody just shuts up and just lines up. The bird goes up, and whoever it flies to gets to take the shot. When I look at elk hunting, I see like a blend of that, where you can go, like you're saying, you went hunting with a buddy and you're not just sitting in a tree waiting for it to happen. You're going to where they are. So that aspect of it to me is like pheasant hunting. You're with somebody, you're spending the time together, you're getting to know people. Oh, yeah. And then when you see the animal, it switches over to deer hunting. Shut up, sit still, don't move, wait for that elk to come in. 1,000%. You know, like that to me just sounds so cool. And it's so unfortunate that now, this past hunting season was the last hunting season for over-the-counter rifle tags for elk in Colorado. Now you have to do the lottery or whatever, which I get it. You know, like locals want to have their elk, and they, you know, I understand why. But from what I understand, bow is still available as an over-the-counter tag.
Nope.
Really?
Nope.
It's bow and rifle have been taken?
I just got an email from them. Yeah, I'm almost 1,000% sure. Bow and rifle over the counter is just not a thing anymore.
That's unfortunate.
Now, there's ways that you can still hunt every other year pretty easily. You know, every other year, you just get a preference point. And we'll connect on this later if you get interested in it, because I've got 3 or 4 units I plan on bouncing around to that don't require a lot of points, but I already know the units pretty well. And so I know, like, if I don't draw my first choice, there's a good chance I'll draw my second, third, or fourth choice. I don't know if they do 4 choices there, but there's a good chance I'll draw one. And then I'm putting in preference points in other states now to kind of hedge against, like I know I can hunt Colorado every other year, but I want to make sure I've got preference points for other states.
Other states where you can fill in the
Yeah, because I told my wife when I think I told her on our first date, it's like, 2 things you got to know about me is, I'm gone for elk hunting 2 weeks every September during bow season. Like, I'm just, it's just a must. It's a fact of life. And I'm going to live on a farm one day. So as long as those 2 things are cool.
That's awesome. And that's when she knew she was going to marry you, right?
That's when she was just smiled and nodded and didn't know I was serious until the first deer season we were together and I was gone at the time. So.
That's amazing. I kind of had the same conversation with my wife, except you got to understand, we grew up in New Jersey. And where we grew up in Jersey, I don't know if you're familiar with like the East Coast, New York area at all. I don't know if you've ever been to New York, but there's the George Washington Bridge is one of the few bridges that connect New Jersey to the island of New York City. I grew up 15 minutes away from the George Washington Bridge. So, you know, your neighbor, your house and your neighbor's house are 10 feet apart, 15 feet apart. You know, every street is lined. You got blocks. There's more houses than trees.
Mm-hmm.
So where I grew up, hunting was like, you hunt? Like, what? You know, and when I met my wife, ironically, she grew up 3 houses down from me. I didn't know her until I was
in my
20s. Yeah. Her best friend is my oldest friend's sister. So that's kind of how like we kind of connected, you know, I don't know, I was like 22, 23, something like that. But I told her I hunted. Now her family, you know, her dad doesn't care, but her mom and her grandmother were like, you're dating a hunter, you know, and like they used to give me so much shit for it when we were younger. And I was like, you keep giving me shit, I'm just going to tell you about my hunts. So I don't know. I don't know what you want me to tell you.
You're giving me shit about something I'm proud of, so
exactly.
I don't care.
Now, fast forward 10 years, because, I mean, we started dating 12 years ago now, I think. 12, 11 years ago, whatever. But now our baby shower theme was deer, Lily's almost here. And it was D-E-E-R, and everything we got is like hunting theme now.
She's,
you know,
on
the
board.
Baby's got like a whole bunch of hunting clothes. My wife was never not on board. You know, I told her right away, I was like, you know, obviously, you know, my priorities are my priorities, but I'm going to make sure I do what I need to do to go hunting. And now that the baby's coming, and do you have any kids? I never even
asked
you.
No, none yet, but,
okay.
You know, definitely in the plans.
I'm working on it. You're practicing though, right?
Practicing, doing the practicing. Yeah.
But, you
still
know.
Learning how, yeah.
Yeah. Now, as the baby is coming, we've been talking about it and we've been planning. And I was like, you know, we bring a baby in the world to, and like to share our experiences with, not to change our entire life. Just, you know what I mean? And like, I know that might sound selfish. I don't mean it to sound selfish. But what I'm saying is like, if I enjoy hunting and then a baby is the reason why I don't get to hunt anymore, like, there's going to be some kind of resentment there and not intentional, you know? So like, we've talked about it and I was like, listen, maybe instead of going hunting Saturday and Sunday, I only go hunting Saturday or Sunday, you know, and I'll go, if I go hunting on Saturday, then I'm home with the baby on Sunday and you get to go out and do what you want to do on Sunday.
Totally.
But where we're fortunate is we have the family cabin. So once hunting season comes this year, she's going to be what, 5 months, 6 months old. So she's going to be old enough to be coming places with us. My mom will be there. My dad will be there. You know, so it's like she won't have to be alone with the baby half of the time that I'm hunting. So it's like it's kind of working out in my favor.
I like
it. You know,
we got to think these things through. Like, I'm gonna ask you a question. Have you ever in the back of your head kind of planned, you know, pregnancy date around hunting seasons?
Honestly, no. It kind of just. It happened when it happened, you know, like we decided it was the right time to start trying and God willing, you know, it happened, you know. So more importantly for me, the wedding in deer season or hunting season was non-negotiable. We were not getting married. We were not having a wedding between September and December. And luckily she was content with a May wedding and it all ended up working out. And at the time, I've never turkey hunted yet. Like this year's going to be the first year I'm going turkey hunting.
Yeah, man.
I'm stoked. And here's the biggest thing. I'm not going with a shotgun. I don't think I want to go with a shotgun.
You're doing bow?
I want to, yeah. Dude, I've been working so hard on my bow for the last couple of years. Like I've been really getting, I've changed my release. I've changed the way I shoot my bow. I've changed my bow. I've changed my arrows. I've changed so much. And I have so little what other people would consider success to show for it.
Mm.
And like, I'm ready to make it happen. There's just something about, you know, when a deer walks in and you see the snot coming out of their nose and you can see that you can see the air coming out and it's so just being the smelling them before you see them, you know, like that to me is just, oh my goodness. So like, I can only imagine turkey being the same, you know, like.
I'll tell you what I tell other people. Just this is my view on turkeys with a bow versus turkeys mm-hmm. with a shotgun. Just my view. I have shot a turkey with a bow. It's awesome. But turkey season's short. Turkeys are hard to kill. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In my state, the states I hunt in, turkeys, you get multiple tags. I'm always, like, I've wasted a lot of almost successful hunts with a bow on turkey. And then I've learned, like, okay, just shoot your first one or two turkeys of the year with a shotgun, with a rifle.
Imagine
with a rifle and your thermal scope at dark. Make sure you just, you know, get the tag.
Yeah, right. Imagine. But don't let anyone see you.
Just get.
We're kidding. We're kidding.
Take the pictures in the morning. No, but
yeah.
Yeah. Just shoot it with a shot. Get your first turkey with a shotgun because you would hate for the end of the season to come around and be like, I didn't get anything because I almost got one with my bow. Yeah. Shoot one with a shotgun and then take the bow off the rest of the time. Just because it's so freaking hard to kill a turkey with a bow.
Yeah. That, you know, Steve said the same thing. Yeah, for the listeners, actually, Steve, I had him on our podcast, I think it was 2 episodes ago, old friend of mine, played baseball growing up, just recently, you know, reconnected, and that's actually how I got to meet Ben. Steve went to go see Ben play live one day, I guess down in Texas.
Yeah, Fort Worth.
And they started bullshitting about deer hunting, and next thing you know, they're hanging, you know, they're talking all the time, and he was like, oh, you like music, you like hunting, Ben's a musician who hunts, why don't you guys get together, you know? But he said the same thing. He goes, I'm going to take the shotgun out first, get my first turkey with a shotgun, and then I'm going to go. Now, I should preface this and say I am spoiled. I got the property.
Yeah.
I have blinds. I have...
That makes a difference. Like,
our blind is literally a full-size shed with windows cut out of it. You know what I mean? So it's like, and that shot from the shed to where I see turkeys strutting all the time is maybe 30 yards, you know? So it's not like the worst shot in the world. And I'm not going to give too much away because we got some big things coming for like Wing and Tail Outdoors coming up real soon. But the arrow that I plan on shooting is going to be designed to take the turkey off his feet.
I love it.
Like it's not, I'm not going to try to take his head off. I'm going to try to completely like, I'm going to try to like, and like rock his world. Like he just got hit with a freaking truck. Like that's my goal. We're just going to leave it at that for that.
And if you're going from the blind, I'll say go for it. You might, if you know, you know the shot situation, if you know the shot situation, cause that's everything. Mm-hmm. Then go for it with the bow. Like if you've got the cover to draw your bow.
To draw and all that stuff. Yeah.
But if you're running and gunning through unknown territory, that's when I say use the shotgun for sure.
Yeah. So maybe, you know, PA, I might, here's the other problem. I don't have the money to afford a turkey choke right now. All I have, like, so I have a Benelli. It's, you know, it's in the safe right now. I should have thought about it. I would have grabbed it, but I don't have an extra full choke. The best I have is a full choke. You know, from what I understand, a full choke isn't quite tight enough for turkey hunting, you know? So my thing is, and Steve and I were talking about this yesterday, he's like, if you go for the bow, try to shoot him in the head. And if you hit him, great. And if you don't, you're going to miss. So it's like, at least you don't wound and injure the turkey, you know?
The one I shot was through, I shot him right, just right through the dead center.
Right through the chest?
With a Schwacker. Yeah. Like I do. And
Schwacker's a Schwacker. So what I've heard, the big problem about bow is you can shoot them in the body with the bow because it'll get through the feathers, but their vitals are so tight that, you know, you don't have a lot of room for error. You know, which is why I'm saying the arrow I want to build isn't going to be, you know, I'm obviously going to try to aim for the vitals, but I have a backup plan of, even if I don't hit the vitals square on, it's going to cause so much damage that it's just, you know what I mean? It's just, you know, whatever. Now I really wanted to get into comparing South Carolina to Texas, but I mean, we're already at an hour and 10 minutes. Like this episode is going a little longer. So, I'm going to cut the conversation here as far as hunting is concerned. If you have like another 5 minutes or so, I want to talk a little bit about bows and setups and all that stuff. I'm just going to go ahead and say, we're going to turn this into a part two. So, you know, if you got some time next week or something, you know, we'll sit down and we'll make a part two.
Yeah,
and you know, in that, I would really like to break down Texas, because like Texas is one of those destination hunting places that like a lot of people love to go to.
Yeah, you're going
to
make me tell people about how good Texas public hunting is. I don't want to give the secret away, but it's been pretty good.
Texas public hunting is terrible. You just know what to do. That's all.
You know, that's kind of true.
We've been talking a lot about bows, and I actually just recorded an episode with another episode. Have you been catching on to have you listened to any of that Science of Arrow Flight series?
Not
that we've been doing.
Not enough of it. No.
Okay.
I think I listened a little bit of it.
No, it's all good. So you and I touched base last time, and you kind of gave me your setup, and I asked him what he recommended you shoot, to be honest with you. And I have a little answer for you here, but I think.
Heck yeah.
Let me see. Where is it? It all depends if you want to shoot, what kind of arrow you want to shoot. But let's talk about your setup real quick. So you have, I know you shoot a Matthews VXR. Give us the rest.
Yeah, so it's a Matthews VXR 31 and a half. It's 70-pound limbs. I shoot, 350 grain arrow. It's 29 and a half inch draw length, 80% let off. What else am I missing there?
Did you confirm that it was 80? Were you able to find that?
I did not confirm that, but I had the bow here. Do we know where on the... I looked on the bow to try and figure it out, but I don't see it on there.
I personally wouldn't know. I'm not too familiar with Matthews. Actually, I grew up shooting Matthews, but the last one I had was like the 2012 or... No, that's a lie. The 2007, 2008 Matthews Outback. Is nice. The last Matthews I had.
Does it make a difference? Like, does 80%, 85% make a giant difference?
So, it depends who you talk to. Think of it like this. So, when you have a higher let off, you have that big drop off at the end of your draw, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you go to draw in and you can feel that valley. And once you get past that weight, boom, it just drops in. And it's really nice. You know, you don't have to hold a whole lot of weight. And you have a little bit of play in it too, right? The second you let up, it's not pulling forward. Mm-hmm. And that's typically why people like a higher percentage let off. They like the feeling of not having to hold as much weight and whatever. But you're a pretty big dude, right? I mean, you seem like you're a pretty tall dude, at least from here. You know, so it's like, think of it like this though. What is it doing to your arrow when you release it? And these are these things that I wanted to dive into, because I feel like there's not a lot of that out there in the hunting realm or whatever. What I mean by that is, you've seen a draw curve before, right? Like a graph of a draw curve. So when you start in the beginning, it starts off low, it comes up, and then you're at full weight for a while, right? So like, let's say you're shooting 70. So it starts at zero and it, you know, it gradually comes up to 70. Then you're pulling a full 70 for a while, and then it drops off the back again.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now think about what happens to your arrow, because your draw curve is going in reverse when you release your string. So you're going from, let's use easy numbers. Let's say you're shooting 70 pounds, which you are, and let's say you have a 90% let off. That means you're holding 7 pounds out of 70. So now your bow, when you release the string, it's going from 7 pounds of pressure to 70 pounds of pressure, then 70 pounds of pressure back down to zero. So your arrow is getting compressed a little bit, a lot, and then a little bit again at the end. So your arrow is doing this as it's going through the air.
Mm-hmm.
But it also causes what they call microflex, which is like, think of your arrow vibrating as it's flexing on a bigger axis or whatever you want to call it. So that's the first issue that comes up with these heavier, these higher let-offs. And the truth is, the difference in 5 pound let-off is a 5% difference in weight, but it's a 30% improvement or change in arrow efficiency. Because the more your arrow is moving in flight, the more energy it needs to waste in order to stabilize that arrow in flight. So the lower your draw, the lower your let off, the smaller the change is from what you're holding to max energy coming out of your bow.
And where that rubber meets the road in a hunting scenario, I believe what we're getting at is like the less flex that has to do in the air, the straighter it's going to be, the faster it's going to find its true alignment in flight.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to affect ultimately the penetration on the animal.
Exactly.
Which is what we all want the most of.
Exactly. Now let's say I'm just going to go ahead and use like a 204 diameter. So not the thinnest arrows. If you shoot, what arrows do you shoot?
Oh, right now I'm shooting, I got Eastern these at Shields. Those are Vengeance SD Shields Outfitters 350. I believe that these are Shields arrows that are actually like a victory shaft. Yeah.
That's fair. Victory. I mean, Victory's a decent company, but what I was getting at was the diameter. So I'm going to try to remember my numbers correctly. I believe a 246 diameter arrow will recover in 18 yards, give or take. A 204 arrow will recover in 20 yards. A 166 arrow will recover in 22 yards. Which means if you shoot at anything under those numbers, your arrow is not done flexing before it hits the animal. So if your arrow is still flexing before it hits the animal, it wastes, like literally, if your arrow is still flexing on impact, you lose 50% of energy before the broadhead is halfway into the deer. You know what I mean? So now here's the benefits of lower let off. First off, if you're talking about on 70 pounds, 5% is 3.5 pounds. So if anyone is upset about 3.5 pounds, I think someone needs to go to the gym. That's just my personal opinion. But more importantly, have you ever tried to carry, you had a farm, you ever carry feed as a kid?
Oh man, 50 pound bags of feed, okay. All day long.
You ever carry it in buckets, like 5 gallon buckets or anything?
Yeah.
You ever try to carry a 5 gallon bucket in one arm?
Well, yeah, my life.
It's not easy. Well, what happens when you put the same weight in your other hand and you walk with two buckets? All of a sudden it becomes easier, right?
Yeah.
It's because your body's in balance. Now, transition that into archery. The closer the weight of holding in the back is to what you're holding in the front, you become a lot more stable because there's more of a balance to what you're doing. Not only that, the lower your let off, the more your bow wants to jump forward. So what does it force you to do? It forces you to keep your form and stay back because you don't have that play. You know if you're drawn on a deer and you let up just a little bit, it's going to want to rip your arm forward and that deer is going to see that movement. There's no way they're not. And the truth is, the difference between 85 and 80% at the range, you take 100 shots, I promise you, you will not even notice the difference anymore. It's just incredible. And I did it myself. I was shooting 85, 90% let off for quite some time. And then I started hearing these podcasts and it's really what got me interested in it. Like as a math guy, I love the facts. I love the science. I love the numbers. So I was like, I have to learn this for myself. So that's how Dorge and I, the gentleman who owns Fire Knock, that's how he and I got linked up. I just kept calling him and asking him more questions and learning more and learning more and learning more to the point where I was like, why don't you come and join us on the podcast? Like, would you be interested in doing a series with me? And he's like, yeah, absolutely.
Do you guys talk about...
Just came from there.
Do you guys talk about... Because this is the part that interests me. Like, and I'm not as like... I'm not a math guy. I'm not as good at like DIY tech stuff. I'm just like, I want to shoot a deer. But I also want to obviously be ethical. So I'm picturing this arrow in flight. I'm picturing me getting a 10-yard shot on a big-ass deer. And then with this new knowledge being like, well, maybe if I had a 20-yard shot, I would actually get more penetration because my arrow had time to straighten out. Is that is that the scenario we're talking about here, basically?
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of different variables that come into it. It's, you know, what kind of broadhead are you using? Like, I know you like mechanicals, so please don't take offense to this. But mechanicals on impact waste a lot of energy because all of a sudden you go from this to this and the arrow's got to push through that. The other thing with mechanicals is if you don't hit a deer perfectly broadside, like if you shoot a deer that's cautering and when a mechanical opens, it's only got two blades. Well, what if one blade opens and it hits the skin and the other blade doesn't? Now there's an uneven amount of pressure.
I agree with that.
Talking, and if you're shooting 300 feet per second, you're shooting over 200 miles per hour. You know what I mean? Like, so there's a lot going on there. But with that being said, the broadhead type makes a difference. The weight of your arrow is obviously going to make a difference. But without the arrow recovering, if we're only talking about recovery, like you have two of the exact same arrows, exact same build, same weight, same broadhead, the only difference is, you know, you shoot one at 22 yards and you shoot one at 10 yards, the 22 is probably going to penetrate better. And I don't just say that. Like if you scour the internet, you watch enough videos, there are people shooting at deer that are right under their tree stand where the arrow only goes in 4 or 5 inches. And with the power coming out of these bows these days, how is that even possible?
It's got
to
be.
There's got to be some kind of answer to that, right? So that could be an untuned bow. Is the arrow going, you know, is the arrow flying sideways and trying to correct itself? Like there's a lot of different factors that go into it. But my thing is like, I don't know which factor is more important than others. What I do know is I want to stack as many variables in my side of the scoreboard as possible. If I could say, okay, my arrow is going to recover, it's going to be fast enough, it's heavy enough, it's got a good broadhead. If I could check all these things off, that puts more of it on me. Can I make the shot? And I just want the confidence that if I make the shot, I'm going to harvest the deer. And if I make a bad shot, my arrow is going to compensate for that bad shot. And that's kind of where I'm at. Like I'm aiming to shoot an arrow that has a 7%. Are you familiar with FOC at all?
A little bit. Yeah.
Okay. So it's just the front of center. Like how much of the weight is more forward than back, whatever. I'm looking to shoot an arrow that's almost perfectly balanced, like 7% FOC, you know, which almost turns it into like a pile driver where the weight is evenly distributed and all the weight is going in. Like think of a train on a track. You know, if you took a train with 10 carts and every single cart had the same amount of weight in it and you hit flat straight on, they're going to pancake into each other versus taking a train that has all the weight in the first two cars and all the cars behind it are empty. Well, what's going to happen when that train hits a wall? The first two cars are going to pancake and the rest of them are just going to fall off the rails. I don't want that energy to go out the side. I want that energy to go straight and penetrate to where I'm going. You know what I mean? So that's kind of like the basis of what really got me into it. And then, you know, there's other things you can do that, you know, that'll tighten your groups up. And the more consistent you are between each arrow as you're building them, you can literally build them and guarantee that every arrow is going to behave the same way.
It'd be sweet to have some like high definition slow motion footage of the flex too between different.
Oh, it's out there. It's out there. If you look at, so unfortunately Exodus just went out of business.
Yeah.
But if you go back and watch some of the videos that they have on YouTube, they actually have like 15,000 frame per second cameras and you can see the arrows flexing right before they impact. It's actually really cool. Like the videos are out there. And eventually I want to do that testing too, but I'm going to stop that there because we're about to get into some stuff I'm not quite ready to share with the listeners.
Oh yeah.
So I think this is a good spot to stop it. And for anyone who decided that they were interested enough to listen this far, I have some really cool things to share. Wing and Tail Outdoors has some really, really, really big things coming in like the very near future. We got some new partnerships coming on. We got some new business ventures coming up. We have different avenues that we're going down. And I mean, as soon as I get the green light, I can't wait to share it with you guys. And I can't wait for this stuff to take off. And it's all going to be built around the science. Like I said, I'm a numbers guy. Numbers don't lie. I mean, they can lie, you know, but that's besides the point, you know. So that science of arrow flight series that we were just touching on, that's on YouTube. It's on Instagram. It's on all the podcast networks. If you want to actually watch the video, that is on YouTube. Like you physically watch us talk. And some of the times that when we're describing things, we're actually like trying to model it. So maybe watching it on YouTube might be better. But it's all out there. And if you guys, you know, if you, the listeners, listen to that, and you can learn some stuff. And again, we're not trying to sell you on a certain product or a certain type of thing. We just, more than anything, we want to get the education out there. You know, so, you know, if Ben Coleman says, you know, I want to shoot a 500 grain arrow with a mechanical head on the front, and, you know, I want to shoot a 166 diameter. Cool. Great. I just want you to know what that's going to do. You know what I mean? And then if you have the education and you say, I'm okay with that, great, fine. That's your choice then at that point. But my thing is, if you're going to shoot an arrow at a walking, breathing, living animal and your goal is to change that, I feel like we owe it to the animal to at least know what our gear is going to do. Because I don't know about you, every time I'm about to shoot at an animal, whether it's a pheasant, a deer, a rabbit, whatever it is that I'm hunting, for a split moment, I always have the thought of, I'm going to be the reason that this animal is not here anymore. I owe it to this animal to do it right.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have that thought?
Oh, ever? Yeah. Yeah. That's part of being a bow hunter is like, well, any hunter, but the discipline involved in being a bow hunter is that you can't take the 35 yard weird quartering shot. Maybe you can't do that. You don't feel comfortable. It's the discipline to wait for the perfect shot where you feel like your skills are going to make an ethical shot rather than just getting excited and flinging an arrow. Like that's years in the making, honestly.
And in my opinion, I feel like the best shot is the shot you choose to not take, you know, and I've done that before. This past year, actually, I was sitting in a tree. I picked it out in the dark. When I got up, there was actually a freaking awesome tree. It was like one of the greatest hunts I've ever had as far as calling and interacting with the deer. It was just amazing. But the first deer that came in, I drew on her. And she didn't quite give me the shot I wanted. And I probably could have taken the shot, and I chose not to. And by not doing it, I got to call a few more deer in and had a little bit more fun. And I got a shot at a deer later on in the day, which was, it was just a great opportunity, you know? So more than anything, it's all about ethics, in my opinion. Like, we want to do right by the animal. And as long as we're doing that, whether you choose to hunt with a crossbow, or you choose to bait or not bait, or, you know, you go to a guided hunt or an unguided hunt, like, to each their own. You know, like, I have things that I'll do and things that I won't do, but the one thing I won't sacrifice is ethics. And if I feel like someone's being an asshole and they're not respecting the animal, that bothers me, and I don't tend to keep my mouth shut about that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I care too much. I don't really know, you know. But anyway, with that being said, we're at about an hour 25. It's went honestly a little longer than I had expected. But be ready for part two. In part two, what I would really like to do is break down kind of your history with rifles as well as bow. Like you said, you started growing up shotgun hunting. You told us why you got into bow. I'm interested to know if you still gun hunt, because we've only talked about bow recently.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm really interested to talk about that. But more importantly, I want to hear about we're going to talk about the difference between hunting private land in South Carolina and then having to learn how to public land hunt on land that you never knew about. Because we've talked about this already, and you ended up finding some really great success on public land, and surprisingly more success than you had on the private land than you grew up on.
Totally.
So guys, if you're in the Texas area, first off, definitely find Ben's next couple shows, because I promise you, you're not going to want to miss them. They seem great. I've seen the videos. They seem pretty great. And if you're down in the Texas area or Colorado, Ben's got some pretty good tactics for you. We actually touched on it on the last episode. We just didn't get to it on this one. So we're just going to make a part two. So if that's something you're interested in, definitely tune in next week. I'll make sure that I post these one week after the other. And that'll be awesome. So do you have anything else you'd like to add today?
No, man, thank you for having me on the show. Like I said, I'm excited to talk more hunting next time and get into the nitty gritty of the hunting stuff too. And in the meantime, like you said, if you're in Texas, look me up on social media and come to a show. I'd love to meet you.
Okay. Where can they find you on social media? Like if somebody wants to find your music, find you, but tell them where to find you.
I'm trying to get all that up and rolling, but basically mostly Instagram, Ben Coleman Music. And then you can find my Facebook page, TikTok, YouTube, all those good places. But Ben Coleman Music should get you there.
All right, and that's on all of them, all the socials?
All the socials, and then Ben Coleman on, you know, like Spotify, Apple Music, or wherever you listen to music. And then I've got the radio song, so if you're in Texas, you might hear me on the radio starting tomorrow.
That's awesome, man. I'm so pumped for that. By the time this comes out, unfortunately, it won't be tomorrow.
That's
It'll
true.
Be like last week the song came out, you know, but I do plan on posting this. This episode's going to post next week.
Heck yeah.
You know, so be ready for that. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks again for joining us this week. I had a really good conversation. I really hope you got some value out of this. You know, if you're someone who grew up hunting in a place where it was a little tougher, it's not the end all be all. You can make it happen. Ben is a testament to that, right? So with that being said, keep an eye out for some of the big things coming for Wing and Tail Outdoors. Hopefully it's coming soon. If you like what you heard today, if you found some value, go ahead, leave a review down below. Leave a 5-star review. If you could, leave a written review. Share this with a buddy. And honestly, if you want to argue with me, that's even better. Like literally, like send me a comment. Like, I don't care. I love talking about this stuff. And maybe it'll give me a different perspective, you know? So until next week, thanks for joining us. And remember, success is just a commitment away. Have a good one, ladies and gentlemen.
Spring break isn't what it used to be. It's better. This spring, stay 3 nights and get a $50 Best Western gift card. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Visit bestwestern.com for complete terms and conditions.
Marvel Television's Wonder Man, an 8-episode series, now streaming on Disney Plus.
A superhero remake, not exactly what we'd expect from an Oscar-winning director.
Action! Simon Williams, audition for Wonder Man.
I'm going to need you to sign this, assuming you don't have superpowers.
I'll never work again if anyone found out.
My lips are sealed.
Marvel Television's Wonder Man. All 8 episodes now streaming, only on Disney Plus.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.